This is Bill Teeple, and I'm here with Alan Cobb and Donna Colby, and this is Icon Art Radio. Okay, Donna, you've got a number of quotes you've brought in today. Let's hear them and take off on them.
Okay, there's three of them. Two of them are pretty directly related, and the other one was just like such a cool quote that I'm throwing it in along with the mix. So this first one was, I found in this old journal of mine, and all it says is Fritz, dot, dot, dot. So somebody named Fritz said this, and I don't know what Fritz or who he is, but anyway, he said this. The only way great things come into being is that someone loved them enough. That's his quote. And then this is a Carl Jung quote where he said, the creation of something new is not accomplished by the intellect, but by the play instinct arising from inner necessity. The creative mind plays with the objects it loves. So those are two quotes. And then the third quote, which really isn't related to those two, but we can make it so because it's the coolest quote. It's by Lewis Carroll, and he said, today isn't any other day, you know.
That reminds me of the proof that you're not here. Now, are you in New York? And the answer is no. Well, if you're not in New York, then you must be someplace else. Yes. Well, if you're someplace else, then you can't be here. That's just sort of in a Lewis Carroll vein.
Lewis there.
I didn't mean to obliterate the context.
So this place is not any other place, or is it?
Yeah. I wonder if that first quote was Fritz Perls.
It could have been. I don't know. When I wrote things in old journals, I didn't really think archivally at all, ever. It was just that, oh, that's cool. And
yeah, well, that's all right.
And so sometimes I didn't even write down whoever said it. So it was...
we'll get back to this love, because I think that drives, you know, what you love is where your attention goes, and that's where you go deep, and you pull out for us all something by that, which is what that was. But I just wanted to say something about the not having all go drab by just staying on the, and I'm trying to connect with what we were talking about before we even started the show. Things go drab and the love goes out when we just start naming and fitting into a chronology. When we look at art history and all the beauty and out there and we start categorizing it. And you were just saying when you grew up and went to the Met every day as a kid and looked at art, you just bounced from this and that, and you liked this, you didn't like that, and you just had direct experience. Mm-hmm. And that art history was, and history that just mostly just categorizes and names and puts dates on things, it's very boring.
Yeah.
That reminded me of the other night. Were you there the night that I gave the introduction to the art history class?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Okay, well, I am going to fit each day into the continuum, the chronological continuum of art history. But I got a lot of feedback from people that loved what I did at that time, which was to just bounce all over the entire spectrum of art history, from the most primitive to the naives of today, which related to the primitives, to the high Renaissance, and then bouncing into the arts and crafts movement, and all over the place, which makes me, I don't know what I'm gonna do when I do the course, because that was so fascinating. I do wanna educate people in how consciousness and intelligence has changed and bounces and moves this way and that as it moves through time. But in any case, it brings up in the context of what you're talking about now, the spontaneous compulsion to go towards something or to learn about something. And the attention doesn't fit well into these like linear programs. It wants to bounce, go here, and then wants to go there, and wants to go there, and it's searching in all of that for like
patterns.
For
yeah,
the juicy
exactly.
Part.
Yeah, and it's all about the juicy part. And yeah. what yeah. you say is, oh, I love that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. yeah.
And I love that. And I love yeah. that. And oh, I've got to go get my friend and bring him over and show them that, or I have to do yeah. a little something that captures a little bit of what's in that, so that I can share it with others. Mm-hmm. So there's this thing of, I'm in love and I want to connect with my other side here yeah. in this place that we can't figure out why it exists, but it seems to exist for this thing right that we're talking about, mm-hmm. that you love to be and to exist, and you want to share it with the other aspects of yourself that happen to be here.
Yeah. Well, and the one of the things that seems to stimulate a tremendous amount of love and recognition is recognition itself. It's you know, discerning the familiar in the field of the chaos, as it were. I think that's why we like music, and I've talked about that before, that it's full of little patterns that we recognize, and each time we recognize one, it gives us a tiny thrill of familiarity. And ultimately, the most thrilling recognition would be of the self itself. Seeing the self in the world has got to be, you know, like suddenly understanding that it's all familiar all at once, and that's got to be an overwhelmingly satisfying sensation.
Yes, and with that you feel at home
right.
everywhere. And,
right.
and you feel that same comfort and joy and freedom that you do
right.
in your own home. And I think that when we were reading that Lewis Carroll quote about today isn't any other day, you know, that's a key as to how to have that kind of experience by actually treasuring the whole combination of things that are occurring right now in this moment, in this day.
Yeah.
And you can even study art history. You know, you were talking about studying the art history and periods of the past through the filter or perspective of what we love today. So that there could be somebody who, in a sense, is putting his or her attention mainly on the past because they're intrigued by a certain era of history. But it's becoming a lie. It's not a dead thing to them. Somebody else who doesn't love that era of history may find it totally tedious and boring to study that. But somebody else may look upon that period of history, even with dates and names and all the things that we think are totally dull, and find it absolutely intriguing. And they just there must be somebody who loves it, because people write, you know, who writes these books that are filled with the dates and the names and things like that. Must be somebody who loves that aspect.
And actually, the dates, and the reason I think they teach dates and their stuff is they know that this is the surface level of
yeah.
it, but it's a doorway in. And they hope that you will come on further in and see that, well, what I feel as a teacher, and I feel that we have to get in order to enjoy history, especially art history, is you have to recognize that that was us then.
Absolutely.
That's the intelligence the only intelligence that ever exists, and it tends to divide up into these different archetypes.
Yeah.
And here we are again, and there we were then. And when that connection happens, then you see that the beauty that was being formed by that artist then, in the context of the time and space of then, is the same experience I'm having when I'm doing it in the context of today.
Yeah, I think one of the main reasons that American history and world history in schools is taught in terms of dates and places is because it's the lazy solution. It's an easy, you can test people on that. It's hard to explain why people did what they did, and it's hard to get kids to you know, explain that back to you to show that they understood it, because odds are in grade school they didn't understand it, and in prep school or high school they didn't understand it. And so the whole thing is a fallacy. The whole course in American history is a fallacy. You're not actually trying to explain how America got to be the way it is. You are, in fact, trying to fulfill a requirement for an examination and a quantification of education, which is nonsense, because education isn't quantifiable. But dates and places sure are, and you can make a history test that will, you know, send fear to the hearts of the most, you know, brilliant minds on the planet, and they will have to bow down to the people who have memorized facts without necessarily understanding a single thing.
One time I was actually searching for books that talked about history in the context of not just school books, but any books, history in the context of how people lived, mm-hmm. everyday life, mm-hmm. at different periods of history. And there were remarkably few books on those things. And just, I mean, really simple things. You know, what were their clothes made of? What was their daily routine like? Mm-hmm. What did they eat for dinner? And, you know, there was a little bits of information here and there, very general, but I could hardly find a book that really went into detail about what life was like, what everyday life was like at different
periods of history. Well, I think part of the problem is that what is considered history, I mean, there's a perfectly valid branch of history, you know, populated by professors and scholars whose concern is to get the facts down as accurately as possible, and you can't blame them for avoiding getting emotional or getting colorful or figurative in their explanation of things. But at the same time, there are people writing books about it, but they're not called history books. Mm-hmm. They're not really in that category. Maybe nowadays they are a bit more. I mean, there have been some spectacular books written by a gentleman whose name I cannot remember. He wrote 1776, which is full of these stories of people, unsung heroes of the American Revolution, doing amazing things, and without whose help the thing wouldn't have come off the way it did, and yet we don't have statues of them and nobody knows their names. I remember 30 years ago or more reading a book called The Proud Tower, and I forget the woman who wrote that, but it was about the way European life was poised at the end of the 19th century and how it almost inevitably led to the First World War. And the things that were going on, I mean, she's got, I think a whole third of the book is devoted to the impact of the development of aniline dyes and how suddenly fabric was colorful. And you could have all sorts of things in color, and color sort of swept across Western civilization like a new range of possibilities. And it's a wonderful way of looking at what life was like then. Mm-hmm. And it's really all history, and it's all about that, but it's so subjective, and it's so much through the eyes of someone with a vantage point that you can't, you know, as a historical scholar, I'm sure, wouldn't consider it to be legitimate.
So that's probably the secret then. It's like, if you want to learn about these things, you just have to look at books about clothing or mm-hmm. about food or something like that. And there probably then are books that go into great detail about how it, you know, the difference in different cultures and periods of history and in those or historical fiction. I think a lot of it's probably why a lot of people like to read historical fiction.
My wife, Janet, didn't like history, but she likes to read historical novels. How she gets into history. And then she starts talking about all the stuff of Mary, Queen of Scots, and all the intrigue and all of this.
And what could be more interesting? It's the ultimate soap opera. It's the story of human life, you know, without having to make it up. The reality far outstrips the soaps.
That's for sure.
My sister's father-in-law was a historical novelist who specialized in George Washington. So for many years until he passed away, I used to see him at holidays and things. And Burke Boyce was his name, and he wrote Man from Mount Vernon and Perilous Night and a bunch of these novels, typically centered around upstate New York and George Washington's youth or early years. And he was an expert on the subject, but he was not writing scholarly material. He was writing novels, and you know, it was all fictionalized. But it had real characters in it, and you could get a sense of people. And when you talked to Burke about George Washington, you got the feeling that he knew the guy. Yeah. And he could tell you why he was behaving the way he was behaving and why he made certain decisions and what kind of a person would be involved in that sort of thing. And I think there's more and more of that now, that's sort of elevated beyond just the sort of pulpy novels of historical characters into just by real high-grade novelists who are also devoted to historical accuracy. Mm-hmm. And then they put the two together in a new way, like 1776 does. And he's written a book on Benjamin Franklin, I think, and a book on John Adams. It was a series on HBO last year or something. And it's just brilliant stuff. You start to feel like these are people again, and they're doing things for human reasons. And they don't know that they're going to be considered great men later on in history. They are just doing what they have to do, and sometimes they're miserable doing it, and sometimes it works, and sometimes it doesn't. And strange factors have, you know, major influence on what they do end up doing, and wasn't all their great thinking. It was a response to the world they lived in.
Yeah. Well, what's really interesting, too, is that when somebody's writing a book like that, they can spend years studying and researching that one person's life. And so we really feel we know that character because we don't do that with each other.
That's
like
right.
All the people that we know, even people we're married to,
yeah,
or you know, grew up with in our family, people we've known for years, our best friends we've known for years, we don't research their lives to that degree.
That's right. We don't deconstruct them. We don't analyze their motives.
We don't know them as well and in as great a depth as these people we read about that somebody else has spent years studying.
That's an interesting thought. What would married life be like if we if we could somehow also study our spouses and find out who they really are and what they really did?
Some people would probably love it if we did that to them, and other people would absolutely
hate it, screaming for the hills.
Yeah, but we don't want to deconstruct our mate.
Yeah, I used to ask someone I was with questions, personal questions about his past and all that, and he just did not want to talk about that. Not because he had anything to hide, but because his attention was elsewhere, you know, fascinate him to do that. Whereas if somebody did that to me, just about anybody, it can be somebody I'm sitting next to on an airplane that I don't even know, if they ask me very personal questions about my life, I'm very happy to tell them in great detail what my childhood was like, you know, what I ate for breakfast in the morning or anything about my house or whatever, because it's fun to do that. And I'm equally interested in the tiny details of anybody else's life, but some people just aren't interested in that.
Yeah. Well, I think history is an interesting thing. Again, it's an illusion that, you know, it's based on the assumption that things happened sequentially, and they happened for reasons that can be more or less unearthed and explained, and that it's this long chain of cause and effect stretching back to the beginning of time. Mm-hmm. When, if you really get into it, it's not like that.
Excuse me.
But it's one big soup of illusion. It's my interpretation of what I'm experiencing now, bounced off of your interpretation of what you're experiencing now, and And then there's memory. I can't remember tomorrow what happened today except for a version of it, which is different than the way I'm interpreting it today. So it's like a soup of interpretations and illusions coming down to us, being transformed every day by who's interpreting that. So there's no real anything there, right. Just like we were talking about in the last show, yeah. In terms of perception.
Exactly. Well, that's what I was thinking. And how many people have said, you know, that when there's a war, it's the side that wins the war writes the history of the war.
Right.
And it's the culture, you know, it's the Europeans who moved to North America who wrote the history about what they found here and what it was worth and what they had to do to make their mark on their new land. And if you ask for the same story from the First Nations who lived here before the Europeans arrived and get their story, it's a completely different story. And nowadays we seem to be interested in trying to somehow match up the two stories and reconcile the total difference of viewpoint. But if you get it further into the details, you find that different Native American cultures were at war with each other before Europeans arrived, and they continued to be afterwards. And there were other things going on. There was a rich interaction of different cultures spread out over a large land area. And they, you know, Europe wasn't the only thing that influenced them, although obviously they wiped them out pretty much. And we were still only barely able to appreciate what was actually done. But it's part of that illusion of it all. You can read about this stuff in grade school, and then you learn a little more about it in high school, and then you learn a little more about it in college, and then gradually you come to the realization that it's all a bunch of mythology. And to put the real story together, it would be a monumental task, and you wouldn't come up with a picture anything like the one that we all kind of share about how the New World was colonized by Europeans at the expense of the Native Americans.
And then at the root of all of that drama and all the other dramas in world history are these universal themes and archetypes of human relationships with each other, like we saw in this Inuit film that Sonia Gunderson brought, The Fast Runner, which was the Inuit legend and epic story that brought out remarkably, all even though this culture by our standards was very primitive and simple in their lifestyle, just completely connected with the earth and finding food and so forth, the same kinds of patterns in human relationships took place in that culture, yeah, that take place in our quote highly civilized culture today. And it was remarkable the way how they portrayed that, how it took you back to that era and time and culture and opened your eyes to a whole new way of, a whole different way of living life than the way we live it. But at the same time, you related to the characters so personally because they were just like us.
And although everything was done perfectly in terms of the igloos and the mm-hmm. clothing and the dog sleds, everything was perfect, mm-hmm. being shot in video, probably high-definition video, made it seem very modern, like it was just us. Like, yeah, those guys, I was, yeah, like I was sitting right there. And in rather than feeling old and ancient and distant, it felt like, oh, I'm an Eskimo, or I'm an Inuit.
Yeah.
And here I am in the middle of this thing, and it seems very much modern in terms of the drama, the soap operas of life. And yet, there was nothing that hinted at anything except very ancient style of living. Mm-hmm. It could have been timeless, for one thing. Yeah. It could, yeah, like no time. It could be in the future or in the past, but it's primitive lifestyle.
Yeah.
And yet, if you've ever nomaded or camped or lived simply at any time, you realize, yes, those are the situations that it comes to.
Right.
If I just get in the car and drive 100 miles out into the country, mm-hmm. I'm now faced with every one of those issues that, like, right. How do I, what kind of an oil lamp do I need to keep, have some light tonight? Yeah. How am I going to, you know, boil my water? It can get really basic real fast, even though we have the modern advancements of today.
Well, and what you said too about the timelessness of it, watching this movie, it was timeless. It's kind of the, on the other hand of that Lewis Carroll quote we started with from the beginning, where he said, today isn't any other day, you know. Well, at the same time, today is every day. It's like all days are the same day, in a sense, because yep. there's that same universal...
Yeah, and
the Ouroboros.
Right, exactly. And when we talk about the illusion, that it, nobody really knows for sure what's going on mm-hmm. in terms of exactly what just happened,
yeah.
relatively speaking, there is something that is... the same. There's yeah. something that is always there.
Yeah.
And it's us, you know, it's, and that That's means right. the self.
We have met the enemy and they is us. I think that was Pogo Possum who said that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's so interesting because we all read Pogo, mm-hmm. but that's the one line that we tend to all isn't that interesting?
Oh, it's
that's
a
the
classic
one line,
line
that all of yeah. us from that generation tend to remember yeah. about Pogo. Yeah.
Such a such a classic. I remember that, and I always remember Albert Alligator striking the match to light his cigar, striking it on the border of the picture
yeah, right,
that
right.
he was in.
Yeah.
And as a kid, that was so outside the box. I just loved it. It was, oh, you mean you can do that? You can, like, but he's not supposed to know about the box around the picture.
And that circles back to what you were saying before about we love things that we recognize,
yeah.
things that are familiar, and even things that we may, like, not like at all now, like Twinkies, let's say, or Hostess cupcakes that maybe we would never eat anymore. There's still some sort of nostalgic pleasure we have in remembering yeah. having oh, those yeah. in our lunchbox when we were little kids.
Yeah.
Listening to Icon Art Radio, a production of Iowa Contemporary Art, Fairfield.